It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with a cyberbullying expert about the surprising number of teenagers who post hurtful messages about themselves. First, a mass shooting at a Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, left 26 people dead yesterday. The victims ranged in age from 18 months to 77 years. 20 people were also wounded. President Trump expressed condolences for the victims from Japan, where he's traveling. He also said this in response to a question in a press conference about that shooting.
We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries. But this isn't a guns situation. I mean, we could go into it, but it's a little bit soon to go into it. But fortunately, somebody else had a gun that was shooting in the opposite direction. Otherwise, it would have been as bad as it was. It would have been much worse.
Well, we don't have all the details yet about the perpetrator in this particular tragedy. Mental illness is often brought up in the wake of mass shootings. Ron Hohnberg is Senior Policy Advisor for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Ron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Ron, what is your reaction when you hear, after a mass shooting, people talk about mental illness as a probable or likely cause?
Well, unfortunately, it happens quite often. And when I heard the president say what he did last night, I was thinking to myself, does he know something we don't know? Because, in fact, there is no evidence to date of mental illness in this case. And yet it happens a lot. And we would never characterize another illness that way. We would never characterize someone as having cancer based on pure speculation. And so the question is why does this consistently happen? And I think probably two reasons. First, historical prejudice towards mental illness and stereotypical assumptions that mental illness equates with violence, which is not true. And then second, it's an easy way, frankly, to divert focus away from broader, more difficult and divisive political issues that have defied solutions over the years.
Let's talk about that first point you mentioned, the link or lack of link between mental illness, mental health problems, and violence. Can you talk about what we know about that?
Well, so we know that mental illness in and of itself is not a risk for violence. There's been a fair amount of research on the relationship, on factors that do increase the risk of violence. And there are certain factors that have been identified, including a past history of violence and domestic violence, which was the case here, use of alcohol or illegal drugs, being young and male, and a personal history of physical or being victimized by physical or sexual abuse or trauma. So mental illness coupled with some of those other factors may increase the risk of violence. And there's some evidence that untreated symptoms of psychosis, such as delusions or paranoia, may somewhat increase the risk of violence, which doesn't mean that most people who experience those symptoms are violent. In fact, most are not. The studies suggest that about 4% of all violence nationally is linked with mental illness, and when you look at gun violence, it's even less than that. So, you know, I've heard an expert, somebody who's really studied this, say that if we somehow could come up with a way to ensure that all people, that no one with a mental illness would have a gun, it would not significantly decrease the number of, it would probably not at all decrease the number of gun incidents involving gun violence in this country.
I understand that there's a link in the opposite direction, that people with mental illness are more likely to be victimized by violence and abuse in some cases, and they may be at more risk of committing violence against themselves.
Well, there is some correlation between, there's certainly a correlation between suicides and mental illness. Significant percentages of people who take their lives have mental illnesses. And while people use a variety of different ways to attempt to take their lives, when people use guns, the consequences are often usually lethal because of the nature of the weapons. So, the conversation has never really focused around what can be done to decrease the number of gun-related suicides. But that's certainly an important conversation that needs to take place.
We're talking to Ron Hohnberg, Senior Policy Advisor for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, after yesterday's tragic mass shooting, looking at mental illness and claims after these kinds of shootings that mental illness was a factor. Ron, are people with mental illness hurt by the stigma surrounding mental illness when we bring up mental health as a cause, even before, as you say, even before we have any evidence one way or the other?
Absolutely. It really, in two ways. Number one, it just reinforces perceptions on the part of people that acknowledging their mental illness and seeking help for their mental illness is risky, that it'll have negative consequences, social consequences, consequences on employment, consequences on housing, consequences as far as relationships that they have. And then there really is one of the reasons, one of the deterrents to people seeking help when they need it. And we want to create an environment that encourages people who are experiencing mental health symptoms to get help, just like we would with any other health condition. And yet much of the way, oftentimes the way we communicate about mental illness in our society goes exactly in the wrong direction and drives people away from seeking help.
I understand, Ron, you've done some work with the gun violence prevention community. Are there things we know that could be effective, maybe not at preventing all gun homicides and suicides, but that at least would be a start?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, we 3-4 years ago, when the focus on mass tragedies first occurred, including several that did involve mental illness, we were really pretty much in a divisive posture with the gun violence prevention community. But recently, we've really started to come together around an approach, and that approach involves what are called gun violence prevention restraining orders, which are basically mechanisms where someone who is close to a person and who may be concerned that the person is not doing well and is at risk of violence, whether or not they have a mental illness, that they can actually get a petition for a court order to have the firearms removed temporarily from the person. You know, there's a due process attached to it, so we don't wrongfully take away people's rights. But I think everyone agrees that it is not a good idea, that it is important to keep firearms out of the hands of people who are potentially violent to self or others. And there have been 5 states now that have actually enacted these laws: Connecticut, Indiana, Oregon, Washington, and California. And at least in Connecticut, a preliminary study that was done suggests that it really has had a positive impact, particularly, interestingly enough, in reducing suicides.
Is there talk of spreading this idea to other states?
Yeah, there are efforts. There have been a number of states, including Texas, I found out this morning, that have had legislation to try to authorize these mechanisms, and it did not pass in Texas, but perhaps there will be a renewed effort in the wake of this latest tragedy.
Apart from these gun violence restraining orders, any other thoughts on violence prevention?
Yes, getting people treatment when they most need it, creating an environment that's conducive to treatment, and doing something in mental health that we haven't historically done, and that is really focus on early identification and early intervention. The mental health system has historically been characterized as a system that really waits until people are in crisis before any intervention occurs, and then oftentimes the intervention is only as long as necessary to alleviate the crisis. So we really need to look, for a variety of reasons, not just because of the violence factor. In fact, I would argue the violence factor is one of the least of the reasons. We really need to focus efforts on how we can intervene early, and once we intervene, we keep people in treatment.
We'll leave it there for now. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate being on with you.
That's Ron Hunberg, Senior Policy Advisor for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. He joins us to talk about the president's comments that yesterday's church shooting in Texas was the result of a mental health problem. First, cyberbullying can have a negative effect on young people, but sometimes it's the adolescents or teens themselves who are posting the hurtful messages. This action takes self-harm into the digital realm. Justin Patchen is a professor of criminal justice at UW-Eau Claire. He's co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. He's with us to share insights from a recent study that showed a surprising number of teenagers say they anonymously posted something mean about themselves online. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you, Rob.
Well, Justin, we've been talking to you about cyberbullying for a long time now. What led you to dig into how young people were posting messages, mean bullying messages about themselves?
Well, we first became interested in this issue in 2013 when we had heard the story of a 14-year-old girl in England who had committed suicide after being cyberbullied online. And when the administrators of the website investigated, they learned that the hurtful messages that were posted by the 14-year-old herself. So she had basically posted these threats and hurtful messages on her own anonymously. And at that point, we had been studying cyberbullying for a dozen years, and we hadn't even considered the idea that teens would post hurtful messages about themselves. And so we looked to see if anybody was studying that problem, and nobody really was. There was a friend of ours wrote a blog post about it at about that time, and another friend of ours from Massachusetts surveyed her university students on the issue of digital self-harm, but nobody had surveyed middle or high school age students. And so last fall we did.
So yeah, you added this to your survey of cyberbullying, and you were surprised by what you found.
We were. You know, we figured it'd be a relatively low prevalence phenomenon, you know, maybe 1 or 2%, which is why we waited for the survey that we included it on, because it was a relatively large survey of, you know, 5,600 12 to 17-year-olds across the United States. And what we found, in fact, were about 5 to 6% of students had said they had engaged in some form of digital self-harm, which was a lot higher than we expected.
Talk about what we mean by digital self-harm. What kinds of specific things would kids be doing?
Right. So what we see most commonly are pretty much examples of what you would think with cyberbullying, just posted by the person themselves. So a threat or a hurtful comment. Sometimes the teen will create a fake profile and then send those messages from the fake profile to him or herself. More commonly, it happens in quote-unquote anonymous apps or social media spaces, so in which case you don't know who posted it. It could have been anyone, and it turns out in some cases it was the target, him or herself.
Before we get into the why this might be happening, it's still more likely, more common, I'm assuming, that someone is being cyberbullied by someone else than cyberbullying themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in our research, in the last 30 days, probably around 10 to 12% of middle and high school age students have been cyberbullied by someone else. And lifetime rates are 30 to 35% roughly.
And what are the impacts of cyberbullying?
Well, we've looked at a lot of different consequences over the years in our research. We know that those who are cyberbullied have academic trouble, have issues emotionally, psychologically, relationally. Many of the same consequences that we've seen in a couple decades of research on traditional schoolyard bullying, we also see with cyberbullying. And so that's kind of been the first step, is to kind of look if they have similar impacts, and it seems as they do.
We're talking to Justin Patchen from UW-Eau Claire. He's co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center, looking at cyberbullying and surprising survey results, finding a lot of young people are posting bullying things about themselves. And Justin, let's get into some of the why someone might do that. Is that something you dug into in your survey?
It is. Of course, that was our first question. It's like, why would somebody do this? And so we included a question on our survey for those who had admitted to us that they had participated in these behaviors. Just a simple open-ended question for us to tell, for them to tell us in their own words why they did it. And we analyzed those data, and several themes emerged. One was self-hate. So some of the young people said that they were just mad at themselves. They wanted to feel worse. They just had this strong sense of self-hate at the time. Most of the responses centered around some aspect of looking for attention. So they were looking for a reaction to see if their friends would, you know, sort of stand up to them, to see if an adult would offer assistance. But just general attention seeking was very common.
We also it's kind of a cry for help, if I can jump in.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in some cases, they said that they had been cyberbullied in a more private way. Maybe somebody was sending them personal messages, and so they were essentially replicating those private hurtful messages in a more public way so that people could see and then hopefully, you know, engage with them or intervene in some way. But in other cases, it was kind of a symptom of some kind of depression. They were sad, they were upset, they were kind of frustrated with life, and you know, the thing we don't know enough about is whether the kind of the causes or the reasons are similar for online forms of self-harm as they are for offline self-harm. We suspect they're kind of related, but they could be different.
Are things different for boys versus girls?
This is another surprising finding for us. All of the public examples of digital self-harm that we're aware of, and I should say public and private, we're aware of two cases that have been kind of in the media, and then one other case that hasn't, and they all involved girls. And yet, in our data, boys were significantly more likely to report that they had done it. So boys were about 7%, girls were about 5.3%. And so we need to dig into that a little bit more to find out if the reasons are different, if the consequences are different. So there's certainly a lot more that needs to be done.
Supposing someone sees this kind of thing going on and somehow knows that a teen is doing this to themselves, and figuring that out is another mm-hmm. question. But mm-hmm. suppose somebody knows this is going on. Are there resources out there to help?
Well, that's a good question. There are some resources for traditional self-harm, whether it's cutting or branding of some kind, burning. But you know, it really requires professional help, counseling, and whether those efforts or initiatives would help with this form remains to be seen. I just don't know of service providers, you know, that do this kind of work if they run into these digital forms of self-harm. So we just don't know. That's right.
Now, how about you see that someone, say you're a parent or teacher, a counselor, you see that a kid is being cyberbullied. You don't know if they're doing it themselves mm-hmm. or not. Are there resources in general for helping with cyberbullying?
Yes, and I think that's the way to approach this. It's not as important who's doing it as much as it is offering help to the person who's experiencing it. So whether it's a peer or a stranger or the child, him or herself, clearly there needs to be resources provided. So if it's cyberbullying that's occurring among classmates at a particular school, then the school will have some resources in terms of intervening. And so the school counselor or other school administrators can take some action, whether it's, you know, some academic intervention or some punishment, or at least identifying that it's problematic behavior and hopefully addressing it. Hopefully parents can get involved to stop the hurtful behavior from occurring. And if all else fails, eventually law enforcement could get involved. In Wisconsin, we do have a statute that deals with misuse of electronic communication devices. So potentially law enforcement could get involved if the behaviors occurring online are sufficiently bad.
As an older generation, looking at these things happening to kids, do we take it seriously enough, or is there some sense that, it's just happening online, it's not as big a deal as something happening in person?
I think we're getting better. I mean, that mentality was prominent 10, 12 years ago when we were first studying these issues, because we frankly didn't know a lot about the consequences. And the research that's been done to try to articulate different consequences between face-to-face bullying and cyberbullying really has returned mixed results, and sort of leads me to conclude that it depends on the child, it depends on the situation. In both cases, whether it's school bullying or online bullying, there can be some significant consequences for those who experience it. So I think that parents and educators are becoming more wise that this is an issue that we need to address. I think we still struggle a little bit with respect to how to respond and what to do and whose responsibility is it, particularly if it's happening away from school. Does the school have an obligation? When does law enforcement get involved? Parents often feel like they don't know what to do. So my response to that is all of those parties need to work together. The first goal, of course, is to end the bullying no matter where it's happening, and then secondly, offer the target whatever resources are necessary to move forward.
How hard is it, Justin, to keep on top of this issue, given that we've moved from, you know, BBSs to email and texting and Facebook to Snapchat and Instagram, and I'm sure platforms I don't even know about yet? It's such a moving target.
It's a moving target, but the behaviors are relatively consistent, whether it's rumor spreading or gossip or threats. And so I don't focus so much on trying, my life is trying to keep up with these things, but I don't focus so much in trying to educate parents and educators about what the latest app is, but instead focus on identifying the behaviors and also in instilling in students integrity so they do the right thing online, whatever app or environment it is, and also a relationship with that child so that if something bad does happen, wherever it happens, they feel comfortable turning to an adult for help.
So the same lessons that might apply for in-person, real-time bullying would apply in many cases to cyberbullying.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's just a different environment. There are some unique challenges in terms of the potential for anonymity and disinhibition and some other things, but ultimately it's really the same problem done in a different way.
And as we wrap up, Justin, briefly, what's your next step in researching this this self-harm cyberbullying?
Well, you know, like any good research, we've emerged with more questions than answers. So we want to look at this problem a much more sophisticated way and try to define the behavior a little bit better. We just had a couple of questions on our survey, try to figure out if there are differences in motivations and consequences, particularly for boys versus girls or other sort of demographic differences. I mean, the first step will be just replicating these results. This is the first study of its kind, and so we have to see if these prevalence rates hold up in other samples of different populations. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Justin Patchen, professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. He joined us to talk about his research on cyberbullying and why teens sometimes target themselves. Now, on the first Monday of each month, WPR Director Mike Crane or Director of Content Mike Arnold joins the morning show or Central Time to share information about Wisconsin Public Radio and answer your questions. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about programming or news coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio? What do you want to hear more or less of? And what do you want to know about WPR's budget, financial operations, or whatever else is on your mind about Wisconsin Public Radio? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. WPR Director Mike Crane is in the studio now. Mike, thanks for coming by.
Always good to be here.
Well, let's start with a story that public radio would rather not have happen, something that's been in the news: allegations of sexual harassment by former NPR Senior Vice President for News Michael Oreskes during his time at NPR and previously during his tenure at the New York Times. We're going to listen to an interview in just a bit with NPR CEO Jarl Mohn in just a few minutes. But you're here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike, you're on the board of National Public Radio. Two different things, but related. But what was your reaction when you heard this story?
Heartbroken. These kinds of things shouldn't happen anywhere. And it's deeply disturbing for it to have happened at NPR, where we're a place with different values than that. And obviously it's taken part in the news, in part because of the Harvey Weinstein thing and so on. It's a big deal in the news right now, but it should never happen at NPR or here.
Well, I mentioned an interview. I want to listen to NPR's Mary Louise Kelly talking to NPR's CEO Jarl Mohn. This is Wednesday of last week. He said that besides the one clear case they had dealt with, there were rumors of other incidents. No victims had come forward prior to the Washington Post story on this. Let's listen to a bit of that interview.
You said you can't act on rumors and gossip, but were you concerned that these accusations were creating a toxic environment in the newsroom?
Absolutely, of course. As bad as... You know,
should that not prompt action then?
Well, it did. Ultimately, we informally were asking questions. Clearly, we didn't do everything we could because it didn't result in the right answer. But to suggest we were not doing anything or we were not acting appropriately is not, or that we were doing nothing is false.
Let me push you again then on what did push you to act and put Mike on leave as of last night and then ask for his resignation this morning. The Washington Post published his story. He was put on leave within a couple of hours. Was that because new information came to light,
came
to you?
Yes.
but you can't elaborate on what that is.
I cannot.
A new case? A new allegation?
New case.
Internal?
Yes.
Current employee?
Yes.
And we've been hearing reports of more allegations coming from within NPR, in addition to the ones that were originally from his time at the New York Times. So what do you think about the reaction from NPR's news department, that interview coverage by NPR media reporter David Folkenflik?
You know, it's one of the toughest possible things for a journalist to do, which is to report on their own institution. It's something we discuss here all the time because as people hear us talk about how we're a partnership of the Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, we have to report on ourselves in the sense of the institution we're part of all the time, and we think we do very well with it, and I think that NPR's news staff has done what they should do and what I would encourage our staff to do in the similar kinds of circumstances, which is do your job, and I know that that's exactly what they're doing.
And when it comes to sexual harassment policies here at Wisconsin Public Radio, what do we have?
We have, as you might expect, the similar policies to most any organization, which is that any kind of harassment is unacceptable. We have a variety of mechanisms for reporting it, including both internal mechanisms, whether it's the opportunity to report it to your supervisor, or if that doesn't feel good, you can report it to the HR department. Or if that doesn't feel good, there is an office outside of public broadcasting, but within the university, an office of equity and diversity that also can accept such concerns and complaints.
As a lot of organizations, media and otherwise, are seeing, there's policy and then there's culture. Is there may be fine words on a piece of paper. Do people feel willing, like they're going to be listened to? Do you think there is a culture at Wisconsin Public Radio that would respect someone bringing these issues forward?
I believe that we strive for that culture, and we'll continue to redouble our efforts to do so. I think that broadly in our whole culture, one of the things we have to recognize is that issues of harassment often include a power differential. And so working together on ways that we can make sure that people feel safe in making those reports, whether it's through anonymity or people outside of the management circles, those sorts of things, that's really important to try to get to that point where this just can't happen in our workplace.
We're talking to Mike Crane, Wisconsin Public Radio's boss. He's in the studio with us for our monthly edition of Mondays with Mike, looking at a lot of things going on at Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll get to your calls in just a bit at 800-642-1234. Some big news here at the Ideas Network, Mike, when it comes to staffing changes, a notable absence in the room with us right now. Veronica Rickert, her last day, sadly, was last week.
Yeah, it's been a time of significant change within our group. Veronica's not retiring, unlike Kathleen Dunn or Joy Cardine, but she has moved on to what looks like a great opportunity for her, and we'll definitely miss her. One of the things that we've been doing for a long time, though, and I think this serves us well, is we've been working on developing new talent that backs up the wonderful folks that are on the air. And that's why, for instance, in the morning, we were able to move very quickly to having Kate Archer Kent take over temporarily for the now generically named The Morning Show, as we move forward for doing a search to find a permanent replacement.
And I'm solo in here for the foreseeable future, but we're looking to bring some of those new voices on during the show. So watch this space on Central Time,
too. That's right.
And some new programming going on from a little bit from the outside of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, one of the things that happens always is the schedule changes, sometimes it's because someone's left or there's maybe a neat new opportunity. And so Sundays at 11 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, we have a new show for us. It's been out for a while, called Bullseye. And it features interviews with authors and musicians and actors and others who share their creative process and projects. And it's something that if you love listening to the best of our knowledge, we think you'll really like Bullseye. Jesse Thorne, who's the host, is a super curious and interesting guy to hear from. And that's Sundays at 11 here on the Ideas Network.
We've got more programming news coming up, Mike, but I want to bring on some of our callers now. We've got Peter on the line in Stoughton. Peter, hi.
Speaking of programming, I'm wondering why between the Ideas Network and Classical Music Network, you play the same program four times a week.
So thank you for that question. One of the reasons, which it sounds like you're an exception to what seems to be a general rule for us, which is it sounds like you listen a really lot, which is terrific. But when we do our research about the crossover between the two networks listening, typically we see crossover of less than 30%, sometimes even 20% of the audience is crossing over between the two WPR networks. And in one case, in the case of our station in Milwaukee, we only have the Ideas Network. And so if there's crossover, it's with our friends literally across the breezeway at WUWM, which is not a Wisconsin public radio station.
So Peter is awesome because he listens a lot.
Yes, you are, Peter.
But he gets some repeats there.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that's, we talk about that a lot when we're doing these Mondays with Mike segments, that designing the radio station to reach the most people, have as much variety as possible, but make sure you've made effective use of the programs that you create. All of that are balanced in various ways. And I know one of the programs we repeat on both networks is To the Best of Our Knowledge. We think that's partly because it's such incredible programming that we'd like to expose it to more people. And other shows have been repeated over the years. We don't do this anymore, but we used to have a repeat of Car Talk because so many people enjoyed it. And we do a little of other things like that.
Thanks for that call, Peter. We have an email from Paul who says, I'm very disappointed that the Kathleen Dunn Show was not replaced with WPR-produced programming. It seems that listeners are slowly losing their voice on WPR. Listeners are losing their neighbors' perspectives, as well as more prominent Wisconsin voices. And the Wisconsin Idea is losing positions for learning and performing roles in program production.
Well, some of that isn't really true. There's tons of people here that are learning in various roles in production and stuff. Our staff is actually larger than it once was. And one of the reasons why we have backups is precisely because there is a team here that can do that. That said, I do understand the point that Paul is saying. And, you know, there are capacity challenges as to how many things we can replace at once. And we had been listening for a while to the program 1A, which is now on in that afternoon slot and has very similar topic bases as the Kathleen Dunn Show had. And we thought, well, you know, if we can find a way to bring that program along someday, maybe we will. For people that have called this very same show or emailed us and asked a year or more ago, you know, why can't you have the Diane Rehm Show on? Because they hear that elsewhere. Well, 1A is actually the replacement for the Diane Rehm Show. And one of the things we were learning from our colleagues is that it was even more popular on their stations than Diane Rehm had been. You know, we talked about Bullseye. Every program is up to evaluation, and we tend to be thoughtful in our taking time to do that. But we really value input like this for helping us make the long-term decisions.
It's Mondays with Mike. We're talking with WPR Director Mike Crane, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you like or love about Wisconsin Public Radio? What would you like to see change? Do you have questions about how things work here, how decisions are made? A particular decision. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is Mondays with Mike. You can join in with your thoughts and questions on Wisconsin Public Radio at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. We've got Tony on the line in Appleton. Tony, hi.
Well, good afternoon. My question for the director is, during an election cycle, the Wisconsin Public Radio is fairly even-handed for the two major parties. But it's my contention that if you're able to qualify and be on the ballot, say the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, or whatever party, these people and their ideas, especially with this upcoming election next year for the governor and state senator, we ought to be able to hear from the other parties, say the Libertarians, the Greens, or whatever, and we don't hear that. And since you're advertising yourself as the Ideas Network, it would appear to me that you should cover the other ideas, short of somebody whose ideas are flat out dangerous or hostile or unhinged.
Gotcha, Tony. I want to get Mike in on this.
Sure. Tony, thanks for the comment. We actually share a value on that very much. And in fact, going back to the 1930s, we've been having political discussions in that season. And it is our policy to invite for statewide offices, which is what we cover most of all. It's our policy to invite anyone who's qualified for those statewide offices, including people from the Green Party or Libertarian Party or whatever. Sometimes they don't accept our invitations, but between the morning show and the afternoon Central Time show, we really do endeavor to make sure that they're all invited. And if they don't accept, we can't do much about that. But most do accept, and it is a part of our trying to help us all have the information we need to have a great democracy.
Tony, thanks a lot for that call. I want to look ahead now, Mike, at some upcoming special programming. We've got a few things going on. What is in the works, Mike?
Well, we've been actually, this is kind of in the works and wrapping up, which is the WPR Next latest program, which is called simply Beta. And as in, you know, you have a beta, meaning trying it out, is like in the computer world.
Beta
and so
testing.
On. Beta testing,
yeah.
Exactly. And it's a really interesting show that one of our most creative producers, who also works on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Doug Gordon, has worked on. And it has sort of cultural collisions. And he asked the question in the latest episode that I'm intrigued by. Are Americans living in a fantasy land? And so I encourage people, if you haven't had a chance to hear that on the radio, although we've, apropos of our earlier call,
repeated
that several times because we want a lot of people exposed to it. It's something you can still check out online and share your comments with us at WPR.org/next.
And then we've got a tribal histories series going on Mondays.
Yes, this is a series that our friends in public television down the hall had been working on for quite a while, and we've now adapted it for radio. And these are recordings and stories that are from natural settings in the regions that Native people have called home for centuries here in Wisconsin. Tribal members share their challenges and their triumphs and their time-honored traditions that have shaped their communities across the generations. And that's airing Monday nights through November 27th. That's at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network.
And then finally, for some special programming, our neighbors to the west in Minnesota have a show, Flyover, that's airing on Sunday afternoons.
Yes,
right?
Minnesota Public Radio has created this show. I actually contacted someone there and said, hey, wait a minute, you stole that name from us. Because we've thought for a long time.
Because they would.
Yes, they would.
As Minnesotans. No, I'm just kidding. Minnesota.
No, they're very nice.
We love you.
But
not your football team.
You got it. But anyway, the reason I said that is that we've talked for a long time about the fact that in Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, we do feel like we're in flyover country, and that we hear in the news all the time a lot more from the coasts, and we'd like to hear more from our part of the country. And so that's the basic premise of the show. It's been a while since we've had a live call-in show on a Sunday, and so it's kind of nice to have that. And that's 3 p.m. through the end of the month on Sundays. It's live and weekly, and it focuses on issues of American identity and the changing American dream, and especially how it affects us here in the center part of the country, what we call flyover country.
It's Mondays with Mike. Mike Crane, director of WPR, is in the studio, among other things, taking your questions. Back to your calls now. Jake is on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Jake, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if there was any thoughts on bringing the 10 Radio Hour back to the air, or maybe moving To the Best of Our Knowledge back up to an earlier spot in the evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Jake, for the call. We didn't find that people were loving the TED Radio Hour, and so that's why we changed it. Sometimes it is a scheduling issue, like you don't realize it, but you've put a show on at the wrong time. So no current plans to make that change, but we have, in the case of To the Best of Our Knowledge, moved it to a couple of different slots over time, trying to find that sweet spot where people are going to find it and maybe nothing else on the radio that's so good, and so they'll stay tuned. Thanks for the suggestion.
And we have an email. Thank you for that call. Paulette emails, what happened to milk? I think that's the Milk Street Kitchen, which took the place of America's Test Kitchen on Sunday morning at 10. The programming on Sunday morning now is irrelevant, not especially interesting. Even reruns of Car Talk were at least funny. Don't we still have that there?
I thought we did, and so I don't know if it was the wrong schedule. I know what it was. It was that we've been running those beta and Entertain Us for a couple
the
of
WPR
weeks.
The WPR Next.
Yes. So shows. Milk will be back. This is one of the real challenges, right? Anytime you want to share something new on the radio, you're taking something else off. And I guess I'd say that I'm glad Paulette noticed, and I'm glad also to be able to say Milk is coming back.
We'll go back to our callers now. Deborah is on the line in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hi. If Paulette gets an older car, she might find Car Talk relevant. But, I just spent 18 days in northern Michigan, and in Marquette, where my hometown, there is nothing like you have here, and I absolutely love public radio here, and it's been my education for the past 20 years. But I called the station manager at Northern Michigan University, a public radio station in Marquette, and he had never heard of The Moth or what was the other one? It was The Moth and
Science Friday was in the notes.
Yep. And I'm like, I was literally in shock. I thought, oh, please introduce this to your students and to the public. I wait for that every Friday. And so I just want to say two thumbs up. Anything that is people disagree with, they need to take a trip north and then they'll come back.
Well, Deborah, thanks a lot for the call. And no disrespect to the public radio there. A lot of places have just one public radio network. We've got two, so we've got a lot more opportunities to do cool stuff for you.
We do, and quite honestly, if we had the resources, we could do a third or even a fourth mm-hmm. public radio station. But that is right that, for instance, we maybe don't realize this in Wisconsin, but there is nothing else like the Ideas Network anywhere. A station that devotes this much time to the kind of public radio, thoughtful, insightful talk that we have on our station. It's unique. Very few things are actually unique. The Ideas Network is, and people go south and feel the same way about what they find when they go south.
And that's why you should pledge right now. Sorry. My training just kicks in there every yep. time. I want to, got a lot more. How about Thanksgiving specials, Mike? We got a lot of those.
Oh, yeah. Thanksgiving is always so much fun on the radio. I hope people put us on while they're making the turkey and while they're...
They can get some help while they're making the turkey.
That's right. That we have that turkey confidential on Thanksgiving always. And we were talking about Milk before. So the first thing at 10 in the morning is going to be a Thanksgiving edition of Milk Street Radio.
Great.
Then at 11 o'clock, we're going to talk turkey with that Turkey Confidential from the Splendid Table.
And they will give you practical hands-on advice. This is a lifesaver for a lot of yeah. people on Thanksgiving.
Like, what do I do? It's not thawing.
It's on fire. It's on fire.
That's right.
Hopefully not that
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, and be really careful if you're frying the turkey, please.
Yes.
I've seen things.
Or the turducken.
Yes. And then finally at 1 o'clock, we've had this as a longtime tradition with the best of the best from the Third Coast Audio Festival. And this is their 17th annual radio documentary competition. This comes out of Chicago, but is an international competition. And so it's something different than you'll hear on the radio most days. And we think you'll really enjoy it. So instead of watching the football game, put on the radio.
Or do both. People can reach us at the Ideas Network Facebook page. There's lots of ways to reach us, but this is kind of new.
Mm-hmm. The Ideas Network Facebook page, we're trying to collect all the different show contacts and so on to one big place so you can be sure to find us. So it's facebook.com/The Ideas Network. And so we hope you'll like us there. We know you like us listening to the radio. It'd be a big help to do that as well.
Mike, thanks a lot for coming by.
It's great to be here.
That's WPR Director Mike Crane. He joined us for Mondays with Mike on Central Time. He and Mike Arnold, the other Mike, split their time between us and the morning show. You can catch one of them on the air Monday, December 4th for all your programming needs. Last week on Food Friday, I confessed to our guest and the world that I had no idea what to do with one piece of produce, fennel. It shows up in my CSA bag. It ends up in the compost unless I remember to bring it, you know, here to work and give it to someone who likes it. Well, Chris on Facebook is not having any of that. Chris writes, Rob, OMG, just slice the fennel, drizzle a little oil on it and put it in the oven. Flip it. Parmesan cheese, grated, fast, easy, no excuses. You can also put the greens in a super salad. I may have read that a bit more dramatically than Chris intended. But Chris, I will give this a try next time I get hold of some fennel. It might not be until next year. On the upside, I did try a suggestion from our Food Friday guest last week. Here it is. I recommend it highly. Garlic chips. I've got a lot of garlic lying around. You take it. He talked us through it. You take it. You slice it up thin, right? It's got a little thin slices of garlic. Fry it up in oil. Flip it a little bit. A little salt and pepper on it when you're done. And you can put it on. It takes away the super garlic taste. Then you put it on your chicken or potatoes, whatever. A little crunchy garlic. But be careful because it goes from almost done to charcoal like within seconds. So I had to toss about half of what I made. But the stuff I didn't burn was really good. I recommend it. Garlic chips. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.